Backstage with Robert Emery.
Hello and welcome to episode number 10 of Backstage with me, Robert Emery. Today I'm interviewing the British stage, TV and film actor Peter Polycarpou. Polly is probably best known for his work playing Chris Theodopoulos in Birds of a Feather, but he's since had a career that surpasses being a TV personality. He was the first actor to play the role of John in the original production of Miss Saigon. He was in the original cast of Les Mis. He played Phantom. He's even danced opposite Madonna in the Evita film. He starred opposite Sean Bean and Charlotte Rampling in the film Clean Skin, and most recently, he starred opposite Kelsey Grammer in Man of La Mancha. In this episode, we dive into what made him become an actor, what his five golden tips are to give yourself the best shot at success in any field of work, and new for this episode, a set of quick-fire questions where we find out the answer to the most important question of all, Les Mis or Miss Saigon. So here we go, behind the scenes with Peter Polycarpou. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello. Hey, it's great to be here, Robert.
No, thank you for coming on. So just so everybody knows, I think we first met really quite a long time. Well, it feels like a long time ago now, when you were doing an evening with Peter Polycarpou at
The Garrick Theatre.
Yeah. And that was a sort of a compilation of stuff which has affected you over the years.
Yeah, the Songs of My Life, I think we called it, didn't we?
Yes.
And it was lovely Jean that found you for me, and I'm so pleased that she did. Yeah, it was...
Jean is your agent.
My agent, yes. Yeah. And it was one of those things where we together really put the material together, and you did some wonderful arrangements, and we had a couple of choirs, and there were lots of people involved, guests of mine that came and sang, and it was at the Garrick Theatre, and it was a huge... great fun and a huge success.
So it was. And then we went on and did a couple of projects together, which is the music of Randy Newman.
Yeah. Laugh and Be Happy.
Laugh and Be Happy.
That's something I devised myself and compiled, put the material together, and found... I'm a great, great fan of his music. I think he writes beautifully for actors as well, because he says of himself, he says, "I write in the third person." He's writing for characters. He's not really in, you know, he's not one of those who writes love stories or love songs particularly. As he writes about events, and I think that's what fascinates me about his writing. And also his writing is so plaintive. He comes from a huge dynasty, you know this, but of great film music writers. There's three uncles of his who have written for film scores for some of the, you know, most iconic movies of the last 50 years. Anyway, that said, we did that, didn't we, in Chichester?
We did.
And again, I've used and done that several times, because I've used the material with different artists and have invited people like Clive Rowe and lots of different people to sing the material. Tyrone Huntley was one of my early discoveries. Well, when I say discoveries, he just came in and sang for me. I just knew instantly that I wanted to use him in something. And Hannah Waddingham and people like that have come and sung it in the past. Beverly Klein. Claire Moore did our Garrick show, didn't she?
She did, yeah.
So I've used lots of people that I've worked with over the years, mined their talents.
Yeah, and talk about over the years. Do you have a memory of when you first decided, hey, I want to be an actor? It's one of the things I want to do with my life.
I think it was when I found that I could combine singing with acting that I realised that that's what I wanted to do with my life. Because previous to... becoming or going to drama college, I'd always sung, and I was playing the piano at a very early age, teaching myself. I played by ear. I'm not a great reader of music, as you know. I mean, I read chord charts, but that's about it. And I realised that when I was on stage singing a song in a character, that is where I lived my life. That is how I was fully myself. So it started at the Unicorn Theatre for Children when I got this part in... it was a rock opera, actually, Sadko and the Fish with Fins of Gold. It was based on a Russian opera of the same name, I think, Sadko. And that was my very first job singing and acting. And it was a wonderful part, this minstrel who sang to the spirit of the river. and fell in love with a woman who kind of came up from the sea and whose father Poseidon didn't want her to marry this young minstrel. It's a lovely story.
Sounds anyway. Epic.
Yeah, it's great.
And when you were a youngster, a teenager, were you always a performer? You know, were you one of these kids at school who could get away with anything because you were, you know, constantly performing and using comedy and you know, is that sort of part of your growing up?
It's an element of that. I think I was always a bit of a joker.
Okay. Were you a naughty boy at school?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I mean, the teachers used to say of me that I had ants in my pants and that I would never be, you know, still for a moment. And I was constantly, you know, inventing stuff to do during lessons. And I think they moved me up and moved me down and they didn't know where to put me. But I do remember being in school productions. I sang Mabel in the Pirates of Penzance in one school production. And funny enough, I have that in common with my wife. So we've both played Mabel, which is quite fun. And I do remember playing the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz at a very young age. And my mum made my tail for me out of old tights. You know, that was lovely. And so that I would have been no more than 9 or 10 then. So
did you grow up in the UK? Or
yeah,
were you born?
No, we were born in Brighton. My sister and I were born in Brighton.
Okay.
And we had quite a... It's quite an interesting childhood in the sense that it kind of forged a very close relationship that I had with my sister. We were in a convent together when we were very young. I was there from the age of about a year, and my sister similarly was there, and she's slightly older than me, so she was there earlier than I was. And we spent nearly 4.5 years in this convent being run by nuns because both my parents worked... And my mum had my sister before she was married. And in Brighton, which we were both born, in those days, there was a small Greek community there. And my mum was rather, you know, shunned by the Greek community because she'd had a child out of wedlock and very orthodox in those days. And so they kind of put us in the convent, keep the children kind of out of, you know, out of people's way and out of sight is out of mind, I suppose. And also to save money because they both work. My mum at that time was taking in sewing. She was a seamstress. My father was a waiter. And they both worked. And in that space of 4 years or so, they saved money. And then we, as a family, we moved to London. And then my brother was born 8 years after I was born, and so I would have been we were as a family were then living in London when my brother was born. So it was a childhood, I suppose, that I still remember. I can still remember the smell of that convent and the you know, the varnish on the floor, and I can still remember the nuns. And I don't remember anything particularly bad happening to me, but I did have a recurring nightmare until I was about 13, 14, being taken to the incinerator and being called, the devil.
Ooh.
And being burnt, you know.
Ooh, that's horrible.
And waking up just before I got thrown into the fire, you know, it was that sort of thing.
Wow.
So, because I think they used to say something like, you're a little devil, you know, you're a little devil. And so I do remember that. Quite distinctly, but I'm glad that you know, that dream stopped, because it's something that I suppose stayed with me for many years after that.
Mm. And was it the school productions that you did, you know, things like The Wizard of Oz, and was it that which sort of really sparked your interest in the entertainment business?
Yes, and there were other things that interested me about it. When my sister and I were quite young also, my parents used to take us to loads of Greek weddings. Lots of Greeks would get married in London in those days. And we learnt some Greek folk tunes. And my mother and father put us on a table, literally in the middle of the wedding, and said, come on, have a sing. And we would sing these folk tunes to the guests at the wedding.
Oh.
And we would have been no more than about 7 or 8 at that time. So... it started from having an interest in singing. I love to sing, and I love to sing with my sister. So performing in that way, And then I suppose putting on a costume, putting on a dress, putting on a bit of lippy as Mabel really did it excited me in a way that I don't think I'd been excited before. So from that point of view, and listening to the audience applaud and just being out in front of an audience, getting that adrenaline surge. I remember that, and I remember the lights, and I remember the stage. Yeah.
So you went to college and did a degree, I assume.
Well, it was a diploma in those days. It's called a London University Diploma in Dramatic Art, and it was part of what is now Middlesex University. And in those days, it was Polytechnic. Hmm. But I didn't stay. I only lasted a year.
Oh, really?
There is a reason for that. I couldn't get a grant. And whilst I was at drama college, I was playing in different bands in the evening. I was working as well to try and afford the fees, and I couldn't afford the fees in the end. And then this band that I was in got signed up by a couple of producers, and I left drama college to pursue a career as a professional musician. And after, I would say, various attempts to failed attempts at being a rock god. I ended up being offered this part that I talked about earlier of Sadko by a musician that I'd been in a band with. And that's how it started for me in 1979. That was my first year in the business. And so I'd left drama college to become a professional musician. And then within 3 years after leaving and being in various bands, this guy, Hugh Trethowan, said to me, "Polly, do you want to come and audition for this part?" And in those days, you need an equity card to work. And that's how I got my first job.
Uh-huh. Now, one of the things that must have changed your life to some extent and really put you on a sort of a national stage, of course, was Birds of a Feather. Now, I don't need to talk an awful lot about that because that was a very long time ago. But how did that affect you ongoing? How has that changed your life? Or maybe it hasn't, but, you know, you're a household name now. People recognise you. Do you think it's directly because of that?
Well, I think there are some elements of people recognising me from Birds of a Feather. I still get that today. But there's very little crossover between the people that know me in the theatre and the people that know me from Birds of a Feather. It seems they are kind of two separate... They feel like, and have done over the years, like two separate audiences. But what Birds of a Feather did do is, on occasion, it actually precluded me from doing some work because I remember a director said to me, "I can't have you in this because you're too well known on the telly for that." Uh-huh. You know, and literally it stopped me from working. But in other respects, it's opened doors for me. So it has been and continues to be a kind of influence on my life because people have, people still remember it. Mm. And it was my first major television role.
Yeah. But since Birds of a Feather, though, you seem to have sort of diverted slightly more into theatre than TV. Was that a conscious decision you wanted to make at the time, or is that just how the cookie crumbles?
Yeah, it is the way the cookie crumbles. I've done a lot of television and I've done some film over the years. But theatre has been my first love, I think. And I spent more or less the first 10 years of my life as an actor in various, theatre companies like the York Theatre Royal or Worthing Connaught Theatre or Leeds or Nottingham Playhouse. And in those places, I would do, rep. And you don't really get that as much these days. And that was kind of my training as an actor. And so having come from that theatre background for the first 10 years, it kind of stood me in very good stead for later on because I still get people who, I think work does breed work. So the more you have worked, people do remember you or, in my case, they have. And they've kind of said to, I work with Peter Policarpo and this is something I found out years later or that they've seen you in something and then they'll ask you to come and audition because they've seen you in something or someone has recommended them, you to them. So, but the theatre's, has always been very important in my life and continues to be,
So In doing research for our chat today, I have to be honest with you. I knew you'd done an awful lot, and I kind of guess I knew most of this already. It's just reading it on one page is quite astonishing. You were the first actor to play the role of John in Miss Saigon when that launched in London. I didn't know that you played Phantom.
Yeah, I was the first Cypriot Phantom, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know you were in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang as the child catcher. I came to see you doing Sweeney Sweeney Todd, yeah. came to see you at the Collie, was it?
We were at
Where
the Adelphi.
At the Adelphi, that was it. I didn't know you were in Mrs. Henderson Presents, which you were in Toronto in that.
That's right, yeah. Funny enough, my sister was there more or less at the same time doing Strictly Ballroom before it morphed into the wonderful success that it was. It was a different show.
You were
show.
There just a little bit before I was there, actually, with Bad Outta Hell.
Oh, yeah.
We went over to Ed Mervish, and I think you were in the other theatre, which is
Alexandria.
Yeah, and that's the closer one to the apartments where I guess we probably stayed in the same.
And then I think it's probably the Princess of Wales, which is the one that my sister was in. And yes, in the same apartment block, which is literally 2 minutes away.
It is, with a Starbucks at the bottom, which is great.
Yeah, and so many great eateries and lovely little jazz venues in Toronto, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And places where you could eat very late at night. And obviously, you know, with being in the theatre, that is, you know, more or less because... You know, you live at night, really.
Yeah, I mean, Toronto's amazing. But sorry, I diverged. I didn't know you were in Evita, the film, with Madonna.
Dance with Madonna, actually.
Yes, yeah, so talking about this, I found online a sort of a diary entry that you did.
Yeah.
And I just want to read a bit of it, because this is very amusing. You said,
I did it for the Times.
Yeah, you said, I also had a dance rehearsal with Madonna's choreographer so I could learn the box steps I'll be doing with Lady M at the ball. This is not something I want to think about too much, because she's a very good dancer and I'm not. It had gone well, and I went back to my trailer not thinking we'd be called again. After I'd been on my back for a few Z's, I got a call that Madonna wanted to do a bit of off-camera with me to help Antonio Banderas' sideline during his bit of the same song. I dutifully went along. However, it was a lot more difficult for me to do, and she got impatient because I was unsure of the new steps. It was a bit of a baptism of fire, but though she was sharp with me, it didn't matter. For me, being in the film has been like being told you're good enough for the big league. Although Madonna is a great ship... which has passed very closely without making any real contact. Not ships that pass in the night, but a great ship passing a windsurfer on the open sea. Still, the premiere of the most talked about movie of the year looms, and I'm in it. Eat your heart out, Theodopolopoulos.
I don't remember. Well, I remember some of that. I don't remember all of it. Not bad, I suppose.
Well, do you know what's interesting is that... With your resume and with your career, and you've done some really huge work over the time, and some very important work. You know, if you went to any kid now at drama college, you want to go into musical theatre, and they look at your resume, you know, they're going to be amazed by that. And what I find interesting about that little diary entry from you is that it's quite obvious that you are not necessarily in awe of Madonna, that would be the wrong word, but and starstruck wouldn't necessarily be the right word either, but you certainly may be a bit intimidated, actually, by her and her status.
I was, and at the time.
Yeah, and I find that a really interesting thing and a healthy thing, that somebody with the resume that you've got, with the experience that you've got, can still be intimidated by somebody like Madonna. I think that's really an interesting thing about your psyche, and does that continue today? I mean, you've just been on stage with Kelsey Grammer at the ENO, and you know he's a big star, and you know there's so many big stars you've worked with over the years, and you are, you know, a star in yourself, but you know obviously compared to Madonna, a worldwide megastar. I mean, do you still get nervous about working with?
Yes,
people
I do.
Like that?
I think what I have is a healthy level of insecurity, and I do not. I know my craft, I think, or I know more about my craft now, and so I'm more confident about what I do, and I'm more confident about social situations and meeting new people and meeting people who are in themselves, you know, very established in their own careers. But I still, I still get a little bit wary of throwing my weight around or of choices that I make in a performance, and I have to get to know someone really well in order. For a performance or a role to work, you have to really work in an intimate way, and sometimes I think a level of trust needs to be achieved for you to do that, and so it's always good to be vulnerable, I think. You have to be open in that sense, so that's where it comes from, I think. Mm-hmm. Is that ego shouldn't take over. I think your ego should kind of go out the door, you know, when you're working with people, and so that you just you try to be as natural as you can be. And I think that's because on a human level, you need to make contact with people in order for that ice to break, or for that difficult part of the rehearsal process to be got through, or text that you really need to investigate. You have to open yourself up for that. So yeah,
I mean, what you've just said there is sage advice. It's that's a golden ticket, which if anybody who's listening to this wants to work in theatre, the phrase "leave your ego at the door" is such a credible piece of advice. I mean, I know from my side, from conducting a show, when I have to deal with egos, you know, it gets boring very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to manage that, and it's a waste of energy for everybody.
And people won't want to work with you.
Yeah.
They're not really interested. Yes, you can be fantastic, and if two people who are, you know, equally talented and brilliant at what they do come and are presented to a director or a casting director for the same role, and one of them's got a big ego and the other one hasn't, I can almost, you know, guarantee that the one that hasn't got the ego or the chip on their shoulder or the, you know, that needs the all of the extra kind of work on the contract is going to be the one that gets the job. Just the way it is. You know,
now going back to Miss Saigon, you know, we both know Claude Michel Schoenberg, who is the composer of that.
Yeah, I'm very proud to say he's a mate of mine.
Yeah,
so.
And I mean, he's an astonishing composer. I guess you must have met Claude Michel whilst you were doing Miss Saigon. I guess you probably didn't meet him before that.
I did.
You did?
Because I did Les Mis. And I met Claude Michel during the rehearsal process on Les Mis. I didn't know him socially then. And I only got to know him socially during Saigon. And then, after Saigon, when it just so happens that my wife Maddie and his wife Charlotte went to school together.
Oh, really?
So quite independently of each other, they knew each other. And we were introduced again socially after many years of working in Saigon. And then we realised that there was this relationship. So it's fantastic. When he got married to Charlotte, it was a delight for all four of us, you know. Mm. And we have got to know each other really well since they were married. But and established a closer relationship over the last few years. And I looked to him, especially recently, for his words of advice and encouragement, or hopefully, you know, pointing me in the right direction, where something that I'm supposed, you know, developing has he came to see recently at the Royal Academy of Music, something that I've been writing for the last three and a bit years, and was very helpful with his advice.
So. Yeah, I mean, he's a very kind bloke. Tell me about Saigon, and
yeah,
of course the big song in that for you is Bui Doi.
Yeah,
actually it's a very difficult song to sing. That it's not an easy piece of music to perform.
Well, I remember I was at the Royal Shakespeare Company at the time when I got the call for the audition, and I had the music. It was faxed over.
Wow.
That's how long ago it was. Yeah. And one of the it was a think a guy called Stuart Brown, who was the musical director then at the RSC, taught me the song because he had some time, and he took me to one side, and I remember it was in E, and it was in A. It was in A.
Right,
I beg your pardon.
Top A.
Yeah, it was in A, and the top note was actually a B natural. And I said, well, the eight shows of this a week is going to be absolutely impossible. It was just right at the tip of my range, and I wasn't sure whether I was going to be able to sing it. Anyway, I learnt it, and I sang it. And I remember going on stage at the Theatre Royal in Drury Lane. I did one audition, and Nick Heitner was with Cameron, and I remember Claude Michel Schoenberg coming up onto the stage after I'd sung the song and giving me the most huge hug, which I thought, oh, I think I've done rather well here.
Right.
And I remember Nick Heitner turning to Cameron, you know, saying, yeah, that sits really well in your voice, doesn't it? But and when we started to rehearse the thing, I realised that, you know, singing this, as you say, it's a huge, huge thing for any actor, that it was going to take it out of me if I was going to sing this eight shows a week. So I asked him if he could take it down half a tone, and he very graciously agreed to it. And I think that it stood me in very good stead, because that has then made it absolutely perfect for me to be able to sing eight shows a week in, because you ask an opera singer to sing something which is, you know, at the edge of their range or in a hard part of their voice, they won't be asked to sing that role more than three or four times a week. Mm. You know, whereas in musical theatre, you have to have lungs of leather. Folds of leather.
Yeah.
And so I absolutely enjoyed doing it, playing the role. I made some great friends. I got to know Jonathan Pryce really well. He was a lovely man. And we used to travel home together quite a lot because we lived quite close to each other. And
there's an old VHS video, which I guess I've still got somewhere, which is the making of Miss Saigon.
Yeah, the documentary,
I
remember
the document. I haven't seen it in donkey's years. I never clicked that you were in that, of course.
I'm in that. There's a very brief clip of me getting a bit tetchy because I hadn't had my mic on. It was almost beginners. And I was getting a bit worried because it was heading to the beginning of the performance. But I must tell you this little story about Saigon, because I'd been in it about a year or so, and I never really stay in a show longer than about a year.
Yeah.
That's my limit. And anyway, I come to the end of my time there, and it was one of the last performances. Anyway, I'm sorry about my
that's all right.
Notifications going on there. Anyway, so I used to have regular chats with the stage manager in the interval. And I'd think nothing that, you know, standing there getting changed and being in my underpants and talking to her whilst the interval was going. Jane Sulberg, her name was, is. And she became quite a famous casting director and works at Regent's Park Open Air Theatre and does a lot of casting. But she was a stage manager in those days. And we'd have these regular chats and we'd, pass the time of day and talk about anything and everything. And as I said, it was one of my last performances. And as we were talking, I got so carried away that suddenly I heard... over the tannoy, the overture of the song. Now, as Bui Doi is the first song, and there is quite a short entr'acte at the beginning of the show, second half of the show. Oh. So I was absolutely worried and kind of screaming, oh my God, I should be on stage. And so I literally grabbed my clothes and started dressing as I was... Have you heard the story or not?
No.
Okay.
Dressing as you were running down the corridor.
Literally, dressing as I was running down the corridor. And... as I got down the corridor, I realised that the iron was still in, the iron curtain was still in, and the whole of the cast were on the stage. And Jane had recorded the overture and put it over the tannoy to be played at three or four minutes before I was due to go on, and they got me, and it was brilliant.
That's
because
fantastic.
the whole of the rest of the cast were gathered on stage waiting for
That's
me,
fantastic.
Seeing me in a state of undress, and it was very, very funny. So I remember that.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a lovely story. But I remember the friends that I made on that production I still know today. Simon Bowman, for instance, and Claire Moore. And I don't see as much of Claire as these days, but Les Longer and Jonathan. So it was a very special time. And Nick Holder. Lovely Nick Holder.
Nick Holder. I mean, when we did Bad Outta Hell in Manchester, the stage manager pulled the same trick on the band. Except the ironic thing is, we were all in the band room just talking in the interval.
Yeah.
And it was April Fool's Day, so they did it as an April Fool's for the whole cast. Nobody knew. And 5 minutes, you know, before curtain up, after the interval, they played the opening sort of 20 seconds of whatever opened Act Two. And of course, we were in the band room. The rest of us were there. All of the band were there. None of us looked at each other and went, well, that's not possible, is it? Because we were all sitting here. We all jumped up, ran as fast as we could to the pit to realise... hold on. Fools,
what did you think they'd done?
Yes. And,
it's like Pavlov's dogs, isn't it?
I know, I've never forgotten that. Okay, I mean, so that was a real highlight of your career. I mean, it must have been a highlight of your career doing Saigon. Phantom's an interesting one because... Phantom is that role where if you speak to somebody who is not in the profession, they go, oh my God, you play Phantom of the Opera, that's amazing. But actually, Phantom is a really small part in the show.
She's only on stage for about 11 minutes, I think, in total.
it's
it wasn't a happy experience for me. I can talk about it now, in all honesty. I didn't fit the role.
Yeah.
It didn't suit me vocally. And Lloyd Webber didn't think I was particularly good in the role.
Did you think you were good in the role?
I thought I was all right, and I still get people coming up to me and saying, I saw you as the Phantom of the Opera, and being nice about it. But no, it probably wasn't my best part. And I think I probably had a bit of an ego then as well. And I think it kind of, it was very helpful in the sense that it taught me that, you know, things can be given to you just as easily as they can be taken away from you.
Yeah, for sure.
And he gave me the elbow, basically sacked me. And so I'm one of a very few select people, you
That's
know,
who have,
like Patti LuPone and Glenn Close, wasn't it, that was sacked?
She was.
Yeah. So I'm happy to be in that club. But it actually taught me a good, you know, a good lesson, I think.
You also played the leading role in a show that I didn't see. I know the soundtrack and I like the music very well, but it didn't do very well, and that's Imagine This.
Oh, right. Imagine This,
and,
lovely show.
Yeah, I mean, the soundtrack is lovely. You know, I've listened to it relatively regularly.
Yeah.
Was that just bad timing in theatre? It was just bad time to get a new show up and running.
If anything was destroyed by the publicity and pre-publicity of a show, it was Imagine This. They had done extensive work to try and figure out how people that survived the Holocaust would take and understand the piece as a piece of theatre. And they had tried, I think, to gauge the response of how people would feel about it in quite a detailed way. And I think that they felt that it was a credible piece of theatre. I think some of the writing of the book was flawed, and we would rehearse and I would ask for different, you know, versions of something, and I would, you know, say that this wasn't right, and because I was playing the leading role in it, and it would come back and it still wasn't right, but they were, you know, working very, very hard. And David Goldsmith, the librettist, was fantastic to work with. And Shuki Levy was wonderful to work with. And Glenn Berenboim, bless his heart, was trying and trying to make this thing work. But I think the book was what suffered very badly during the rehearsal process. And it didn't really, for me, you know, work properly in the same way that the music did.
Yeah.
so the two... You know, the combination of telling the story within that kind of ghetto situation and then having a story within the story was a lovely idea, but the writing, I don't think, was of sufficient quality to make it work.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have a show without a phenomenal book.
Yeah, and the book just didn't really gel together in that way. I love the music, and I still...
lovely set design as well.
Yeah, and I thought that worked very well. And... Tim Sheeder, the director, I think, did a phenomenal job of it.
Such a shame, but hey, things are meant to be. I want to talk to you about accents.
Yeah?
Because I watched your showreel last night, made me laugh a lot. I love the comedy in...
Threesome.
That's really great.
It is a very funny show.
But I watched this showreel, which you've got Threesome, The Lost Honor of Christopher Jeffries, Hustle, Lehman Brothers, Clear Skin, and Tyrant. And you're all doing different accents. And you've got a real talent for accents. Is that something which you had training on, or is you've been able to do that?
It's developed over the years. I've got a good ear. Musically, so I'm quite attuned to the way people speak, and I'm always fascinated by how people speak and syntax particularly, and so the way that people construct you know, sentences when they're not speaking a language which is their own is something that you can pick up on, and it's very helpful. It has been helpful for me as an actor.
So when you need to do a certain accent, how do you get to the point where you're happy with it?
I listen to a lot of people speaking in that accent. I do go away and do quite a lot of research before I actually attempt to do it myself. And then I try and mimic it in some way. Mimic the inflections, mimic the rise and the fall and the way that, as I say, the sentences are constructed. I try and improvise around what I'm hearing. And I'll speak along with it so that I try and get a feeling for the person
who's speaking. I mean, when you're making a cup of tea in the house and you're talking to Maddie, and I mean, do you carry on in that accent.
I do. I've done it. Oh, I've done it in the past. Definitely. I've spoken like, you know, a whole day trying to perfect an accent and talking in a particular way. And I've done quite a lot of Arabic parts and, you know, and again, quite a lot of American parts. And there are subtle differences in the American accent and trying to be really, really on point with it and make it as precise as you can be. I think if you... As an artist, I think one of my bits of advice would be to strive for the very best that you can be. And that means going beyond what you think is, I think you should challenge yourself to the point where you're actually scared. So that you've got to, I think when you take on work, there ought to be an element of fear in some of it. Can I really do this? And there ought to be an element of am I, you know, there ought to be a question the whole way through. Is this the right approach? Am I getting this right? What should I do here? Is there something else I could do? Choices that you make are really terribly important as an actor. And I think sometimes that we get too easily satisfied with what we do. And I think you have to be your own worst critic or best critic. I don't know whether that makes sense, but you have to be someone that really, I think, analyzes and continues to analyze a performance all the way through a run. Never ever be too set in what you do. Always be willing to challenge yourself and to try and do something in a different way. Now, I know some actors will say, well, I've only got one line, you know, I've only got a tiny bit to do in this, how can I do that? And I think there is there's something in that you have to approach, I think, your work in a way that is going to, if it no longer motivates you, if it no longer interests you, if you're getting bored in what you're doing, that's the time to really go do something else, try something else, because there are so many people out there competing for what you're doing and competing to be in the job.
Yeah,
that you've
and
got.
Have a hunger for it. Yeah.
Yeah, not only hunger for it, but can be probably do it just as well, if not better than you.
I know. And talking about doing other things, everybody knows you as an actor. And one of the reasons why you're here today, apart from to talk with me, is because you've written a musical. So you're a composer as well.
Well, I don't know what I've written yet. I'm not sure it's a musical yet. I'm not sure what it is, to be honest. It's a bit of a hybrid, but I've written something which is based on my own experience. I've used my musical ability for whatever reason. And I'm not sure what musical ability I've got, but I have written this thing from my heart, and it's something that has come from my own experience. And I'm hoping to develop it. I think there are elements of it which I think are interesting. There are other elements that when Claude-Michel Schoenberg came to see it, for instance, at the Royal Academy of Music, he pointed out that he said one of the criticisms that he had of it and me in my writing was that he said something like, you cut off the branch on which you are sitting. Which I think is an interesting criticism. So there is, I think, more work to be done on it. Yes, I've written it. Yes, I'm passionate about it. I still believe in it as a piece. I want to develop it further. But it's been going for about 3 years. And I know that any musical takes between a germination period of about 5 to 7 years. So it's still got a way to go.
I mean, I think I was there at the workshop performance with Claude-Michel. And I remember one of my sort of overall criticisms of the piece, and one of the things that, you know, I'd like to work on with you, is that you've got what I suppose one would call new composer syndrome. And I was doing an interview with a film composer last night, actually, for this podcast. He'll be the guest and the episode after this. And one of the things he was saying is that the first film he wrote, he's very proud of it, but he goes back and listens to it, and he's also quite ashamed of it, because he said he was so excited by this, he wanted to throw in every style of music he could think of, because it's this new thing, and he wanted to show the world what he could do, so he wanted to throw everything in there. And I think one of the interesting things about your piece is it's got a slight similarity to that, which is it's very innovative. It's got a really, really some beautiful moments in there musically, but I can tell that you are still trying to find your feet, find your sound, find you as a composer, which, you know, you've done as an actor. But what made you want to write music? I mean, that's such a different skill from being an actor. I mean, I could never be an actor. It's just not within me, I don't think. So, you know, and essentially that is the same, you know, I'm a musician trying to be an actor. I mean, I'm not saying you're trying to be a composer and you want to be the next Claude Michel Schoenberg, but nevertheless, you've done this and you must want to do it. So what made you want to go, okay, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to pause my acting for a second and I'm going to spend 3 years doing this.
Or yeah, I think it's a fair criticism you make as well about having to wanting to show, put too much in and show what I can do. And why did I do it? Well, look, I've always written music and songs, but privately, and I've never foisted them on anybody. I've done some of them, you know, performed some of them in little jazz venues or little things like that. And I have, it's always been a companion to me, music and songwriting, and in private. But I suppose I reached the point where I had this story in my head and I thought, well, I can't tell this any other way. And I've got some ideas, and they started to formulate around the book that I had in my head. And it was a particular story that, like I said, is semi-autobiographical, that I felt lent itself to my music. And I suddenly found that what I was writing helped me to tell the story that was in my head. So that's why I started to do it, because I thought, suddenly, this is making sense to me. So I continued with it. I had one song and I realised, oh, actually, that's quite good. I'm happy with that. Let's put this to one side and let's see if we can write something else which fits this part of the story. So I started with what I would call a song cycle, which is around the book that was in my head that was still formulating. And then after I'd written the songs and most of the libretto, I then went and said, well, now how can I put these ideas which are around the story that I wanted to tell into book form? And that's how the book itself was written. So it's an unusual construction method, but I wanted to tell the story that was in my head, and that was has been and continues to be the major motivating force for me. Yeah.
So essentially it's a hobby which is turning out into something which could be something, maybe, and but you're not going to quit acting and suddenly try and be, you know, the next Lloyd Webber. This is something which is you choose to do from a personal pleasure point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. But it's also something that I believe will work on a professional stage. I have the experience to know that when I worked with the students at the Royal Academy of Music on my piece, that they were sufficiently excited by it for me to realise that actually it does have an impact, not just on them, but on an audience. And it's interesting to hear from an audience. So from the point of view of a piece of theatre, I know it works. Professionally, it can work professionally. I now have to get, I think, the themes of the music in a more solidified way. And I probably need someone else to come in and help me with the book, because I don't think that's right yet. And I need someone to maybe do another treatment of it.
But it's nice, but that it's you a can work in progress.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know that. And this is something that I've seen from the performance.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about you is that you're constantly busy. You've just come off stage with the ENO, and then you're going on to another project which starts in next week or the week after, and there's another one after that. And I've never known you to not be busy, which means that you must be productive. And one of the things that I like to find out with people who I work with is, what are the tips and tricks that make you ultra productive, and how do you manage that in your life?
Well, I've always tried to combine my musical ability with my acting ability. So on several occasions, I've lied about being able to play an instrument for an audition and then gone away and learned something.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I have, for instance, I learned to play the banjo for a part in The Front Page, and they said, can you play the banjo? I said, oh, yeah, I can. So I learned over a period of about 3 or 4 weeks before I auditioned for it, to play something little on the banjo, and I got the part. And I also learnt the bass guitar for a part, that was a play called Front Page. And then there was another part in a play called One Night Stand where I learnt the bass guitar, because I could play a little bit of acoustic guitar. So I've used that. And that's, again, that's kept me busy where I might have been out of work for a bit. And then on another occasion, I played the acoustic guitar in a play called The Amazing Dubrew Angle Dodge. And I've always, as I said before, played the piano from quite a young age. And I've used that in two separate productions, one more recently in the play called The Choir at the Glasgow Sitz Theatre, where I was playing this choir master who played the piano and accompanied, it was an actor kind of musician production. So that has helped me to give myself more opportunities to work. But at the same time, I also made a choice that I was not going to just do musical theatre. And I needed to turn down musical theatre. Because after Saigon, for instance, I got a lot of offers to do other big West End shows. And after my experience on Phantom, Saigon, I realised that I could, if I wanted to, stay working musical theatre for a long time. But that's not what ultimately I wanted to do with my career. So I made a decision to turn down musical theatre work and just do work on a smaller scale. So I went to the Finborough, and I went to the Gate, and I went to the Bush.
So you opened yourself up to lots of opportunities.
On a smaller scale.
Yeah, sure.
To try and learn more about my craft, yeah. Learn more about the craft of acting, yeah. So that I could be taken in inverted commas more seriously, yeah. As an actor rather than just someone who came from an empty background.
You are so busy though, and when you do a run like Man of the Mantra at the Colony, you're doing 8 shows a week. How do you manage that? How do you keep yourself on form? You know, do you meditate? Do you work out? Do you have a healthy food regime? What's the physical or mental things that you do to keep yourself on form when you need to be on form for 8 shows a week?
Okay, I tell you, you have to have some discipline. Okay, there's no two ways around it. I can't do what I used to do when I was in Saigon, and I used to have late nights, and I used to go out drinking, and I used to do a lot of stuff I shouldn't have been doing, and I was young. But now I'm older. I don't drink after a show too much. I might have one drink. I try to get to bed fairly early. I make sure that I don't overtax my voice during the day. I look after it, and I do eat more healthily. You have to really balance what you do during the day so that you're right for the evening. So I'm constantly, as soon as I wake up, I'm gently warming the voice up during the course of the day. I will drink a lot of liquid during the course of the day, so that loads of, you know, warm tea and not something that's too hot, and so I'll get myself ready for the show that way. And I think it, your social life suffers when you're doing 8 shows a
yeah,
week,
sure.
And I'm prepared to take that on, you know, on the chin, and not do the stuff that I used to do, and just get myself ready and be, you know, my life revolves around the show. And especially with something recently like Sancho Panza, which is a tough thing for any actor, you can't be doing too much other stuff because you'll just lose your voice.
Mm.
And so I really look after my voice.
Mm.
And I make sure that, I mean, I would wear, I mean, it sounds crazy, but during the rehearsal process, I would wear something around my throat to keep my throat warm. And I would keep, you know, a bottle of liquid with me all the way through the rehearsal process. And, you know, you just have to really look after it and be careful.
Mm.
So that's the sort of thing that I do. And I also, I do have a little routine before a show. And I say mantras. I do, and it's a private moment that I do for myself. And I don't want to talk about it too much, but it's something that keeps me focused, that gets me focused. And it starts about during the five for me. And I'll do that for about 5-10 minutes, and then I'll be ready to do the show.
Mm.
So that's a regular thing.
That's a form of meditation, actually, then, by
it
the
is.
Sound of it.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things I find more and more is that when I'm speaking to people who are really at the top of their game, one of the things that seems to connect almost all of these people is that meditation comes into their life in some way, shape or form. I find that a really interesting thing. It's something which I've grappled with over the years, and I've always found it very difficult to achieve, and it's something which I would like very much to try. And, well, I say try and find some time. I guess that's the stupid thing about meditation, is that you always can find time.
You make time.
Yes, exactly.
You don't have to find time, you just make time.
Exactly.
But and it's the one key thing is that what you're doing is you're telling the mind that this is about to focus me in a way that prepares me for what I'm about to do. And there are very simple early little meditation things that you can do that are very, very easy to do and will only take 5 or 10 minutes of your time. And one of them is, for instance, for someone who's never meditated or has meditated very little, is a breathing meditation. And literally all you try and do is, for about 5 or 6 minutes, is just think about your breath and nothing more. Mm. What will happen is you'll suddenly start wandering, your mind will wander, and as soon as the mind starts to wander and you notice it wandering, you just say, oh, well, let me think about my breath now.
Yeah.
And you come back to your breath. And if you try and discipline yourself, after about a week or so, or maybe even longer, you'll start to just notice what the breath is doing.
Mm.
And the in and out of your breath, and in through the nose or out through the mouth, or in through the nose and out through the nose, whatever way you choose to breathe is fine, and whatever, and in whatever speed that you choose to breathe is fine too. But you'll notice over time that the breathing becomes more and more interesting to you, and that becomes more and more the focus of what you do. And that stills the mind. Because what it does do is it disconnects the mind from all the thoughts that are going on the whole time in your brain. Whilst we're talking together, you're thinking about a dozen other things probably that you're going to do later on today. You're thinking about how ill your cat is. Mm. You're thinking about, is this going to, you know, edit together properly?
Mm.
But all you're doing is you're getting rid of the extraneous thought and giving yourself a little bit of peace for 5 minutes. And that peace is a gold mine.
Mm.
It's a wonderful, wonderful gold mine that you can kind of just draw little nuggets out of, and it will help you, and you'll start to develop in other ways a kind of inner center, a core of relaxation, which you need as an artist, because it's such a demanding thing that we do. It really is.
Yeah, for sure it is. And it's something which, as I say, I've been trying for years, and I need to not try, I need to do. And that's definitely something which I'm going to think about over the next couple of days. What's your prediction of where the entertainment industry will be in 20 years' time? And that could be whatever you want, music, theatre, plays, whatever you want.
Yeah, funny enough, I did write something about that, and I'd like to read this, if I may.
Sure.
So I think, is there someone mowing their lawn?
There is.
Okay. I think it's incredibly difficult to predict where the business will be in like 20 years' time, but I think with the advent of new technology, there will be more and more online productions. I think the influence of Netflix and Amazon on television and film can only increase. Smaller specialist channels like YouTube and you know, and Vimeo, is it called?
Vimeo.
Where work by emerging talent is produced. I think those will increase over the years. And I think what Netflix is doing right now is it's spending more money than anybody else on new productions and new drama and new period stuff. And it's very interesting how that's going to develop. And I think where Amazon will be the same. I think many more people were making films with their phones.
Mm.
You look at Steve Soderbergh, who made a whole movie with his iPhone. These methods of producing work will increase, I think, over the next 20 years. Theatre and plays and musicals will always have an audience. They have done since the ancient Greeks. And I can see that I can't see that changing, you know, in any fundamental way. There'll always be you know, auditoria for people to work in. I think there's more scope for collaboration, though. I mean, what you did particularly when you're working with people who come from a rock background and putting you know, contemporary musicians together with people from the theatre, I think that's a very, very positive you know, advancement. I mean, look at what Bowie achieved in the last years of his life with that wonderful thing. And I think Sting produced some very interesting work as well for the theatre. And then Mark Knopfler's just written 20 new songs for his the remake of his film Local Hero.
Yeah.
So I think what's coming out of that, for me, seems to be, and what happened at the National as well, that with The Light Princess, I can't remember, was it Vega who wrote the music for that, which was fascinating. I think people coming from contemporary musicians and rock musicians, or any kind of musician that working with people from the theatre who are creative in a different way, but a kind of symbiotic way, is very interesting. I think that's where I see it developing to as well. So, yeah.
That's fascinating. Very well prepared answer. This is a new thing that I'm going to try out on this podcast, and it's some quick fire questions.
Oh yeah, go on.
So I've got 10 of them. You've not been prepped on this at all, no idea what I'm going to ask. Are you ready? Here we go. Number one. One person you've never worked with that you always wanted to.
One person I've never worked with that I've always wanted to. Probably Robert De Niro.
Okay. Number two. If you weren't an actor, what would you be?
A teacher.
A drama teacher or a generic teacher?
Probably a teacher. I don't know what I'd teach, but
some form
maybe of languages.
Okay. Number three. If you could have one thing in the world right now, what would it be?
Your car.
Good answer. Number four. What is the proudest moment of your career so far?
The proudest moment of my career... it's probably when I got nominated. I know for an Olivier for Oslo.
Well, that's a very special thing.
I hope it's not too big beheaded, but
no, you should be proud of that. It's an
achievement. I am proud of it. Yeah.
Number five. What's the worst moment of your career?
Getting sacked by Andrew Lloyd Webber.
It's a good worst moment to have. Number six. What's the piece of music that you wish you would have written?
Wow. Probably Brahms' third symphony, one in E flat.
Wow.
I think it's that one. It's
superb
just
choice.
Extraordinary piece of music.
And number seven, what's a piece of music that you really can't stand?
You know, there's very little music that I absolutely abhor, but the thing that goes da 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 da
da da da da da
I can't stand that song.
There we go. What's that? What is that? Birdie song. That's
yeah,
what that's
gonna that
be.
For me.
Okay,
is cool.
Okay, fine. Unfortunately, though, it's an earworm, and you will think about
yes,
that for the rest
probably,
of the day.
Yes, I'm sorry to
very
the audience.
Very kind
listening.
Of me.
Yeah, yeah.
And number eight, what's the instrument that you wish you could play?
Oh, I wish I could read the piano better than I can. But if I was honest, the bouzouki. I'd love to have been able to play the
really?
Bouzouki. Yeah.
And what about an instrument number nine? An instrument that you hate?
An instrument that I hate.
You can't stand the sound of.
I don't know whether there is an instrument that I hate. And that's a very difficult question to answer. A kazoo.
There we go. And finally, number 10. Les Mis or Miss Saigon?
Saigon.
There we go. Polly, I mean, thank you so much for spending the time of doing this today.
I didn't even get to my Victor Spinetti story.
Well, go on. Tell me about your Victor Spinetti story.
Or my other one. I'm not sure which one to tell because I wanted to say that he was a great inspiration to me. We did a play called Comic Cuts together on tour, and I used to drive him from one place to the other. And I was his chauffeur, and I used to listen to him talking in the car for hours on end. He had the most wonderful stories about the Beatles who he'd worked with and, you know, all these fascinating people that were part of his life. And he used to say to him, he said one thing which stayed in my mind. He said, never be too in love with what you do, because sometimes, you know, changes happen. So that's what he said. Never be too in love with what you do, because I have found to my cost in working in new plays in particular, when things are written and then suddenly the writer will have a different idea and that gets cut. And you think, oh, I really like that bit. I love that bit. Or a moment, for instance, when I was doing Les Mis in the previous stage where I had this fantastic section where I was climbing up and it never made it to the, you know, the actual ending of, you know, the completed show. During previews, I had this fantastic sequence where I was pretending to be Jean Valjean with a dummy of Cosette on my back, being chased through the centre of Paris, climbing up, you know, 40 feet up into the fly floor, and then pretending to slip down, and everybody loved it, and it got cut. And again, you know, so never be too in love with what you do, because I think you can your ego will be damaged quite severely. So that was one thing that Victor left me with. And another thing was that you never know who it might be that you're talking to. Mm. So when you're talking to people and you're having conversations about what you want to do and what where you want to be, then just be very careful about what you say. I remember before I was an actor, I used to work in this factory for a short time, making putting plastic bags on dresses, and I'd be having breakfast at 7:45 in the morning. This guy in this fierce guy arrived, practically bald with this wart right in the middle of his forehead, and he'd arrive on a motorbike and he's sitting in to have his breakfast. And we got into, over a period of days, got into having a conversation because he'd been at the same time as me, and we maybe had breakfast together or a cup of tea together before I started work at 8 o'clock. Anyway, so these conversations would last about 10 minutes. I remember telling him about my dream of becoming an actor, and I hated working in this factory and I wanted to be an actor, and my dream is to be an actor. And he said to me, he said, well, you know what? He said, you know, live your dream, mate. Live your dreams. And I said to him, yeah, well, I'd like to. And he said, you know what? He said, I've got a play coming out next week. It's down in the East End. I said, really? I said, yeah. And I knew nothing about the theatre. All I had was this dream in my head about being an actor. So 2 years later, cut to 2 years later, I'm walking by a bus stop in Islington and I see this guy's face on a poster. Massive, great poster. And it's the guy that I've been talking to, and I found out, you know who that was?
Who?
That was Stephen Berkoff.
Oh my word, yes, of course.
And then cut now to 30 years later, I'm very good friends with a guy called Gregory Gudgeon. Gregory and I went to see a Berkoff's production of On the Waterfront at the Haymarket Theatre. And we went back afterwards to see the great man because Gregory had worked with him, and I was desperate to meet him because I'd never seen him from that day forward. I went back and he was in his dressing gown. It was very grand, and he said hello to Greg and he was introduced to me. He didn't know me from Adam. And I looked at him, he looked at me, as if to say, haven't I seen your face somewhere before? And I told him this story. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, and now look at you. He said, you've become a very successful actor. You lived your dream.
Oh, what a wonderful story.
That's my story. And it's a true story, and Gregory was there to witness it.
That's amazing. I mean, what I find interesting about you, Polly, and you don't realise this because this is just inherently you, is that you've got four bits of golden advice today. One is what did you say, from not love your work too much?
Yeah, never be too in love with what you do. Yeah.
Two is you never know who you're going to speak to, so try and respect everybody. Three is leave your ego at the door. And four is, on top of all of that, you have to go above and beyond what you need to do to be satisfied. And having that self-criticism and that motivation is something which can make the difference between a wonderful actor and a mediocre actor. And in fact, a wonderful musician, a mediocre musician, and you can apply that to almost anything in life. And those are four bits of gems of advice. And the interesting thing is that you've come today to have this chat with me, and you're sitting in front of your iPad. You've got all of that stuff written out. You've thought about it clearly, concisely. It's something which you didn't think, oh, do you know what? I'm just chatting with Rob and we'll just make it up as we go along. And that is just so stereotypical you. And I think everybody can learn an awful lot from that. And if you are a young actor listening to this, or a young musician, or anybody in any profession, and you're trying to make it, you can apply those rules to you. And I do believe that that will help you out enormously. And I hope that you continue to give that advice to everybody you meet. And you've certainly helped me out from that side. And I think it's a wonderful thing. Keep on giving it, keep on doing it. And I think you're a lovely man. And it's a pleasure to know you. So,
oh, thank you, Robert.
Peter Polycarp, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks again to my friend Polly. I think we all agree he's got an incredible take on life and is a real inspiration to all. Once again, I'd like to thank Lat56. They make my life easier when travelling by supplying me with the best luggage system on the market. And nope, I didn't get it for free. I paid 100% of the cost and was happy to do so. So from me, RDCE, ciao for now.
The backstage.